This morning, in keeping with the season, I want to preach the greatest story ever told. I want to preach on the crucifixion of Jesus. The Bible simply says in Luke 23:33 that when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left. I know the story is familiar, but I want us today for a few moments once again to stand at the cross of Jesus, to come with hushed steps and pause in quiet wonder and amazement to behold the depth of God's love for a sinful and dying race. For at the cross, mercy and truth have met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed each other. At the cross, hell vented its hottest rage and heaven bowed in most tender mercy. At the cross, the door of heaven is open, a fountain of salvation is unsealed, and it is there that the head of the serpent is bruised. There he was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities, chastised for our peace, and there that the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. At the cross, he was both the giver and the gift, the buyer and the price, the shepherd and the lamb, the priest and the sacrifice. It was there that Jesus appeared at the interlocking of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And as the ruby red beads of blood dripped from the veins of Emmanuel, they beat out the tune of redemption, regaining a lost world and redeeming a lost race. God stood the cross in the center of time as we see it. But for God, it stands above all time, redeeming every second of every millennium. Famed preacher R.G. Lee said it this way, and I quote, "Before time began its solemn march, heaven considered the ruined of fallen man and resolved not to spare the greatest gift that time could know or eternity could produce." Axiomatically, the cross is central in Judeo-Christian history. All that precedes it is preparation. All that comes after it is consequence. And every virtue of Christianity is present in the cross. And every sin is also there as well. And in this strange mix, we confess that it was for us that his virtue must answer for our vices. The cross was his long before the tree from which it was made was even a sapling. It belonged to him before the cosmos was framed. Long before God ever spangled the black canvas of night with 1,000 glittering constellations, the cross belonged to Jesus. Yes, the cross was raised in the sands of the first century, but its shadow falls across all eternity. Jesus lived all of his life in the shadow of the cross. From his childhood, he knew it awaited him, and yet he faced the cross with an unshrinking resolve. The writer of Hebrews said it this way, "For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross," meaning that he looked beyond the temporary pain to see the lasting glory in bringing many sons to God. There's an old gospel hymn that we sometimes sing, "When he was on the cross, I was on his mind." Indeed, for Jesus had us in mind when he lifted the cup and blessed it to 12 men with Aramaic names. While he drank, Christ had no misgivings about the morrow. He knew that somewhere in the city lay his cross already hewn. He knew that at that very moment, one of his disciples was already a turncoat who that same day had been haggling betrayal with graybeards in the temple. He knew the contract price agreed upon was 30 pieces of silver, which was a pitiful sum whose current equivalent would hardly be worth more than $30. And yet he never flinched. With unswerving determination, he accepted the cup from his Father's hand, and he drank it for us. His suffering began in the Garden of Gethsemane. With his disciples, he had left the upper room, crossed the Brook of Kidron, and entered the garden to pray. And with his soul sorrowful unto death, he went further into the garden, fell upon the ground, and through the crisp night air his voice could be heard. As he cried, "Father, all things are possible to you. If it's possible, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done." And while his disciples slept, he prayed alone. And at that very moment, Judas, the disciple who would betray him with a kiss, was leading the mob to the garden where Jesus was. He prayed with such intensity that his sweat became as drops of blood. It is a rare physical condition known as hematidrosis, in which great emotional stress causes the tiny capillaries near the surface of the skin to rupture, and blood will mingle in the sweat glands, and it's sometimes called bloody sweat. And it was there in the garden that the blood of Christ was first shed. The soldiers came into the garden and seized him. One of his disciples pulled out a sword to fight for him. Jesus told him to put it away. "Don't you understand," he said, "I could ask my Father for 10,000 angels, and they would fight for me and deliver me." And that's true. At any moment, Jesus could have stopped this ordeal. But he submitted into their hands. And if you ask why, it's simply because he understood that the way to God must pass through Christ and his cross. The only reason the crucifixion came to be was that there simply was no alternative. There was no other way. Had there been any other way for us to be saved, there would have never been a Calvary. Our Lord would have never endured the ugliness of it all. But because there was no other way, he endured the shame of the cross. Had there been some less expensive way, the Son would have never gone back to the Father with scarred hands, nor would he have suffered a naked death before his mother. And in the garden, the soldiers tied his hands behind him and, according to Roman tradition, pulled them up between his shoulder blades, and then a rope was placed around his neck and he was led away like an animal, and in fear and panic, his disciples forsook him and fled. He was taken first to the Jewish leaders, who questioned him. In their savage hatred of Jesus, they abused him. They beat him and slapped him. They spit in his face and pulled the beard from his cheeks. They mocked him. This continued through the night. The next morning, they took him to Pilate, the Roman government. Mind you, they had no valid charges against him, but they had lied to the governor and brought false accusation and perjured testimony against him. Pilate examined him, a man thoroughly acquainted with examination, interrogation. And his professional opinion was, "I find no fault in him." But the bloodthirsty crowd screamed for his death and shouted, "Crucify him." And Pilate said, "He's done nothing worthy of death. I will therefore chastise him and let him go." At that point, Jesus was stripped to the waist and his hands tied to a whipping post. I remind you, those were not the hands of a criminal or a traitor. Those were hands that had blessed little children, that had healed the sick and raised the dead, that had opened blinded eyes and made cripples to walk. The whip they used, you probably well know, was called the Roman cat of nine tails, with many strips of leather, with lead and pieces of bone embedded near the ends. When it was drawn across his back, it would rip open his flesh. The prophecy had said they made long their furrows like a plow. They had plowed his back. The blood ran from his sagging body and formed a puddle at his feet. This type of beating was so severe that many prisoners did not survive it. They died at the whipping post. When the beating was stopped, his hands were untied and he fell to the floor in his own blood. Sadistic in their humor, the Roman soldiers put a robe across his shoulders, placed a stick in his hand for a scepter. They made a crown of thorns and placed it on his head and made Jesus king for a day. In mockery, they bowed down before him and said, "Hail to the King of the Jews." They beat his head with this stick, driving the thorns that were 3, 4, 5 inches long into his brow. And finally, tired of their cruel joke, they snatched the coat from his back. And of course, by that time, the robe had become adherent to the clots of blood in his wounds, and its removal was the same as carelessly removing a surgical bandage today. So that when they ripped it away, it caused excruciating pain as wounded flesh was torn from his back. Pilate brought him back before the people and said, "Behold the man," and they answered, "Crucify him." And finally, as an act of political appeasement, Pilate consented to their desires and passed the sentence of death upon him. The crucifixion took place just outside the city of Jerusalem at a place called Golgotha. And as was the custom, Jesus, as a condemned criminal, had to carry his own cross. The soldiers placed the heavy crossbeam upon his back and led him through the streets. And as he walked through the streets, the angry, jeering mob followed, mocking his every footstep. He tried to carry the cross, but he couldn't, because by this time he was exhausted from the lack of sleep and the loss of blood, and he stumbled and fell. As a matter of practice, the Romans always tied the hands of the prisoners together over the crossbeams. Because his hands were tied in that manner, he couldn't even put out his hands to catch himself when he fell. And the weight of the cross drove his face, already bruised and battered, into the hard cobblestone street. The soldiers made a young man named Simon to carry his cross. When they came to Golgotha, they stripped him of his clothes except for a loincloth, and they crucified him there between two thieves. The soldiers placed his hands on the cross and drove huge spikes through his flesh. Then they did the same to his feet. They lifted up the cross and dropped it into the ground, causing the flesh in his hands to tear. When the cross was jolted into its socket, 10,000 angels drew their swords against an unfeeling planet. They would have turned planet Earth into an ash heap. They waited for his command, but it was never given, and the world was spared their wrath. And the only explanation was that Jesus was in love with a lost planet and a dying race. Over his head was an inscription in three languages, Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, King of the Jews. Latin, the language of government. Greek, the language of culture. Hebrew, the language of religion. And of course, the other language present there was Aramaic, which was spoken, which was the language of the common people. And though they did not intend it as such, they actually proclaimed Jesus as Lord of every realm. The crown of thorns, of course, was still upon his brow. At his feet, Roman soldiers gambled for his robe. It was the only thing he owned. The crowds insulted him and mocked him. His mother, Mary, and some other women stood near the cross weeping. One of the thieves joined in with the crowd and mocked him, but the other said to him, "We deserve to die. We deserve to die in this way because we're criminals, but this man has done nothing wrong." Little did he realize that he had uttered the gospel in miniature. We deserve to die. He's done nothing wrong. We are guilty. He is innocent. That is the essence of the gospel. The innocent dying for the guilty. The righteous dying for the unrighteous. And it is amazing to me that the only theological reflection upon the death of Jesus that day came not from the learned tongues of the scholars, but from the tortured tongue of a thief. Jesus was, of course, put to death unjustly. In his whole life, he never did anything wrong, and the people hated him without a cause. And yet the Lord, in his love, prayed for them, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." At noon, darkness suddenly covered the earth, and in agony, Jesus cried, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" For in that moment on the cross, all of the sins of mankind, yours and mine, were placed upon Jesus Christ, and He was bearing the just penalty of sin for us all. And in that moment, even the Father turned away. Death on the cross was death by suffocation. The muscles in the arms are paralyzed and the muscles around the chest cease to function. Air can be drawn into the lungs but cannot be exhaled. To breathe, Jesus had to push Himself upward with His feet to relieve the pressure on His arms. And that's why when they nailed them, they almost always nailed them with their legs bent to prolong the agony. And of course, as He pushed Himself up and down on the cross to relieve the tension on His chest so He could breathe, He was rubbing His back up and down against the rough wood, and His back, already wounded and bleeding, was torn open again. Eventually, carbon dioxide builds up in the lungs and in the bloodstream, and then another agony began, a deep crushing pain in the chest, as the pericardium, which is the membrane around the heart, slowly fills with fluid and begins to compress His heart. His compressed heart struggled to pump heavy, thick blood into the tissues. His tortured lungs gasped in small gulps of air. Finally, His heart ruptured, and at last the agony was over. Doctors say that Jesus probably died of a ruptured heart. After He died, the soldier stuck a spear in His side to be sure He was dead. When they did, blood and water flowed out. And according to doctors, they say that's the only way that blood and water can be mixed together in the body is for the heart to rupture. Indeed, Jesus did die of a broken heart. A heart that was broken by my sin and yours. And standing near the cross was a soldier whose daring whisper of truth was heard above the clamor of unbelieving slander when he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." For 6 hours, Jesus endured the horrible agony of crucifixion. But before He died, He lifted His head and cried, "It is finished." God's plan to reconcile man unto Himself was complete. Then He said, "Father, into Your hands I commend my spirit." He bowed His head and died. And when He died, the veil in the temple that for centuries had separated men from God was torn open from top to bottom, signifying that no longer did mankind have to be separated from God ever again. How wide was the tear, you ask? Wide enough for the biggest sinner in all the world to pass through and find forgiveness, and never again would that veil separate men from God. They took His body down from the cross and laid Him in a borrowed tomb. And for 3 days, He was dead. But on the third day, He was raised to life. Resurrected by the power of God. When His disciples went to the tomb, they did not find His body. Instead, they were met by angels who told them, "He is not here. He is risen as He said." Jesus Christ is not a memory in a Palestine tomb. He is alive forever. Muhammad is dead. Buddha is dead. Confucius is dead. Abraham is dead, but Jesus is alive. I am the first. I am the last. I am the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and hell. Hate had scourged love. Hate had ringed love with thorns. Hate had pierced, torn, and mocked love. But love won. It continues to win. For there at the cross, love hangs, loving the haters, forgiving the assassins, dying for the sinful, caring for the unconcerned, bleeding for the wounded. At the cross, love won. Calvin Miller, the poetic genius that was his, wrote it this way. Poor souls, we are without purpose. From battle to battle we run. We are orphans who nervously search for a father to call us his sons. Anxiety throbs in our head. Our mind tries some purpose to see. There's a strange empty vacuum of pain in the place where our hearts ought to be. There can yet be life for the lifeless. The hopeless have one hope sublime. For our Master has driven his cross in the cascading decades of time. Come, let us move from the foment of life and refine all the gold from the dross and fasten our purposeless living to God's wonderful assurance, the cross.